Before I begin, just a quick word to any graduate students or recent PhDs in this room. If any of you are interested in a postdoc with me at Clemson University, please come and see me sometime after this event. I'd like to begin by considering the animating theme of this conference. The general theme of the conference is, can American institutions still be conserved? And the theme of this panel is, what does fidelity to our founding principles require today? If I'm being honest, my answer to the first question is maybe, perhaps, hopefully. But it's hard to be much more positive than that. To paraphrase that famous line from Hungarian communists in the 1950s, situation hopeless, not yet bad. It is the job of conservatives, classical liberals, and even libertarians to conserve that which represents the best of our intellectual, cultural, and political traditions. Sometimes, however, conservatives are prone to invoke the Jeremiad, a literary form that is most often presented as a lament, an exhortation, and a calling. A lament for things lost, an exhortation to recover what is true, good, and beautiful about our society's manners and mores, and a calling to come home. The American tradition of the Jeremiad began with the first generation Puritans in the 1650s as they assessed the vices of their children and grandchildren. The American Jeremiad tells the story of declension, decay, and disintegration. The Jeremiad, broadly understood, is not, though, a uniquely American tradition. Instead, it seems to be a timeless and universal tradition for cranky old men. From John Winthrop and Cotton Mather to Russell Kirk and Junior Soprano, old men like to lament the manners and mores of their progeny. For all of the hand-wringing associated with the Jeremiad, it does serve, though, I think, a useful function in society. It serves as a remembrance of things past, certainly of the good and sometimes even of the bad and ugly as cautionary tales. The one obvious problem, though, with the Jeremiad is that it can become predictable, stale, and boring, certainly to the young, which is the cause of their perpetual eye-rolling. My talk today is a kind of Jeremiad, but with a twist. By any objective measurement, we now live in a country that can be described as one of the most immoral in world history. Let me share with you a few examples chosen from all too many. We now live in a country whose ruling class openly and embraces and rejoices in the mental and physical mutilation of its children. We live in a country where it is now okay for mothers to have their 8-year-old sons participate in drag queen events, to put them on body-changing and life-altering drugs, to prepare them for surgeries, to remove their sex organs, and to deny the rights of fathers to object to this evil. We now live in a country where the government school system requires young children to read pedophilic books such as Gender Queer, which depicts a young boy performing fellatio on an older man. We now live in a country where frontline soldiers are forced by their military commanders to use reality-defying and truth-denying gender-neutral pronouns. I could go on and on, but a life of futile pessimism is not much of a life. And so we are directed to the question assigned for this panel. And my answer to it is twofold. First, fidelity means that we must actually be true to the founding principles. And second, we must fight. We must fight to preserve those principles. Now, obviously, these answers are too simple, if not simple-minded. We need more. What does it mean to be true to America's founding principles? First and foremost, it means that we must understand, champion, and defend those principles from all enemies, foreign and domestic. As I'm sure all of you know, the founders' principles have been under attack from the progressive left for 130 years or so. In more recent years, however, some on what we might call the reactionary right have also judged and condemned America's founding principles as either irrelevant to the needs of the 21st century or as the source of the maladies that afflict us. So, what does it mean to fight? It means that we need to know why we should fight, what we are fighting for, and how we should fight. Why do we fight? The why question is the simplest to answer. We must fight as an act of devotion to those we love, to our parents, spouses, children, friends, neighbors, and fellow citizens. And we must fight to save the country we love. We must also accept as a moral obligation the responsibility to fight for those things that our forebears fought, namely freedom, the freedom that was institutionalized during our revolutionary founding period. Men without chests do not deserve their freedom. This means that we must reject the politics of compromise and cowardice, but it also means that we must likewise reject the politics of despair, and with it the politics of nihilism that some on the right have turned to in recent years. Simply put, we must resist the temptation to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I assume, or at least I hope, that the members of the Philadelphia Society can at least agree with me on that. The more difficult questions to answer are the what and the how questions. What are we fighting for? What is it that we seek to preserve? The mission of the Philadelphia Society is, in part, to preserve the principles and institutions on which this country was founded. We defend them not simply because they are ours, and not simply as an exercise in filial pietism. Rather, we defend them because they are true. And that's the rub. How do we defend the truth of the founders' principles when it is said that we live in a post-truth world? A world in which we are now supposed to refer to men as she, her, and hers, or as I, Zim, and Zir. When we speak of those principles and institutions to which we owe fidelity, the quickest and easiest way, I think, to sum them up is to defer to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The writers and signers of the Declaration spoke not so much of principles, but of truths, moral and political truths. Truths they considered to be absolute, inalienable, universal, and permanent. Presumably those truths are as true today as they were in 1776, and thus they are still worth defending. The Declaration lists four truths, each of which can be summed up with a single word: equality, rights, consent, and revolution. The least discussed of the Declaration's four truths is probably the fourth, the right to revolution. The Declaration's revolution truth says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Built into the heart and soul of American conservatism is the revolution truth, which says that the people have a right to alter or abolish their government if it repeatedly denies or destroys the individual rights of the people, that is, the rights to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, and a series of corollary civil rights. In other words, it is conservatives and classical liberals who must conserve the revolution truth. The Declaration's revolution truth is borrowed from John Locke's second treatise of government. Locke's goal was to establish objective criteria for judging when subjects or citizens are justified in resisting or rebelling against the laws and actions of their rulers. Locke's first criterion concerns when the legislative is altered, his language, which includes, one, when a ruler arbitrarily alters the electors or ways of election. And two, when a ruler delivers his subjects or citizens into the subjection of a foreign power. Locke's second criterion, sanctioning revolution, arises when rulers act contrary to their trust. Governments that repeatedly violate the fundamental rights of their citizens not only deserve no respect or allegiance, but they are in fact criminal institutions that must be overturned. And I will leave it to your imaginations to determine whether Locke's criteria are relevant in the context of 2022. For now, though, let's fast forward to 1776. The Declaration's right to revolution indicates the conditions under which revolution is justified, whereas the rights to life or liberty are simply absolute, the right to revolution is contextually absolute, which means its application is context-dependent. Interestingly, the first words that follow the fourth truth, the fourth truth is prudence, which is the practical virtue determining when revolution is both justified and propitious. According to the Declaration, prudence dictates that revolution must be the last resort of the people against rights-violating governments. There are times when exercising the right to revolution would, in fact, be imprudent or foolhardy, even though the people might be justified in doing so. Determining why, when, and how government should be altered or abolished is a complicated question, both in theory and practice. The Declaration identifies the challenge as twofold. First, governments with long and venerable histories should not be changed for light and transient causes. Second, history teaches that men, and I'm quoting the Declaration, are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. The question of timing is therefore critical to the founders' theory of revolution. The question raised by the Declaration is, when exactly is revolution both justified and prudent? The first thing to note is that one act of injustice or tyranny by the government does not justify revolution. There must be, according to the Declaration, a long train of abuses and usurpations, and a settled design to reduce them under absolute despotism. Having reached that point, the people have, the Declaration says, both a right and a duty to throw off such government. Fast forward now to 2022. Ask yourself these two questions. Do the criteria established by Locke in the Declaration apply to contemporary America? Are the American people freer or less free today than the American colonists of 1776? In thinking through the implications of these questions, the first thing to note is that the context of today is completely different than it was in 1776. And it's also important to note that the criteria used by Locke and American revolutionaries are not the only criteria to determine whether revolution is justified or how to do it. Remember, the right to revolution is contextual and contexts change, and those facts are particularly relevant to the prudence question. consider two concrete examples. First, Locke and Jefferson claim that revolution is justified if the legislature is altered. Ask yourself this question. Has the administrative state changed the nature of our constitutional republic? Second, Locke and Jefferson claim that revolution is justified when rulers act contrary to their trust, which is to protect the rights of their citizens. Ask yourself this question. How many laws passed by the federal government since the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 have violated the rights of American citizens? Now, these are all interesting theoretical questions. And let's say, oh, hypothetically speaking, that our government has become a soft despotism with a clear design to become a hard despotism. And again, hypothetically asking, how should the American people respond to this state of affairs? Quoting Comrade Lenin, what is to be done? And this takes me to my final question. How should we fight in 2022? Let's begin with the obvious. 2022 is not 1776. The source of our despotism is not 3,000 miles away. It is here, it is now, it is everywhere. It can be felt, but it is largely unseen. The deep state is deeper than any of us know. We see only a fraction of its size, power, and influence. This means that 1776, as a matter of prudence, cannot be a model for today. Revolutions, though, come in many different forms. Armed rebellion, for instance, is not a necessary condition for revolution. There can be what we might call a velvet or a silk revolution. There can be invisible revolutions that transform a nation over the course of decades. This much I know. 21st century revolution must be a nonviolent, bottom-up revolution. It will be largely a leaderless revolution. To borrow and flip a concept from the cultural left, it will come in the form of a long march away from the institutions. The revolution, therefore, will be mostly a quiet revolution, an underground revolution, a samizdat revolution. We shall follow the path explained so brilliantly in Václav Havel's indispensable essay, The Power of the Powerless. We need millions of Havel's green grocers who will say, no, I will not tell a lie. I will no longer sanction evil. I must live in the truth. Still, we must act. There are things that can and must be done. First, we must identify those institutions that are vulnerable to capture, to being altered, or better yet, to being abolished. Here's an idea. It turns out that the single most immoral institution in the United States, the one that has done the most damage to America, the one that is the embodiment of despotism, is also the one that is most vulnerable to not only being altered, but to being abolished. And that is America's K-12 government school system. But how do we abolish an institution so deeply ingrained in American culture? The answer is simple. We withdraw our sanction. That's it. To that end, I've dedicated my public writings in recent years, both at my Substack, The Redneck Intellectual, and at my website, edwatchdaily.com, to encouraging what I call the hashtag Just Walk Away movement. And the good news is that the Just Walk Away movement is happening without the Republican Party and without the DC think tank establishment. In fact, it's happening, ironically enough, because of COVID and of the utter stupidity of the education deep state. The COVID lockdowns promoted by the education establishment sent tens of millions of children home for over a year and a half to be miseducated online, where parents could see and hear for the first time ever what their children were actually learning or not learning in the government schools, and they were shocked and horrified. They learned that their kids were being indoctrinated in critical race and gender theory. They learned that the schools were actually grooming minor age children to transition to the opposite sex via life-altering puberty blockers, hormone therapies, and genital mutilation. And all of this they tried to keep secret from their parents. And we all know the result. Over the course of the last 2 years, a large group of American mothers, and if the revolution is to have leaders, it will be the mothers of America, who have now been designated by the Justice Department and the FBI as domestic terrorists. They were radicalized. America's mothers were radicalized, and they began protesting at local school board meetings all over the United States. More importantly, millions of American families joined the Just Walk Away movement, and they have pulled their kids from the government schools. Many of those families are now homeschooling, some are going to private and charter schools, and others are creating micro schools and education pods. This is the great exodus. As a result, the government schools are imploding. Students and teachers are leaving in droves. The system cannot be sustained, and it must not be reformed. We must, therefore, support the principle of separation of school and state. Which means that we must be abolitionists. So, how do we get from here to there? Here's a back-of-the-envelope five-step program for abolishing the government school system, and I'll be very quick, Richard. We must, one, delegitimize the government schools, not only as failing in practice, but as immoral. Two, encourage ordinary Americans to just walk away. Three, rescind all laws regulating homeschools and the creation of micro-schools and education pods. Four, we must require all Republican politicians to pledge they will support abolishing the Federal Department of Education and its 50 state surrogates. And five, we must take whatever steps necessary to decertify the so-called education schools. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the revolution. And the leaders of the revolution are ordinary Americans. This movement will not be stopped, and the revolution will not be televised. We have a critical mass, and there is no going back. Dusk is approaching, and the owl of Minerva will soon spread its wings. And so, all of you sitting here today, you have a choice. Either you join us, or you get the hell out of the way. This is a warning. If you are a conservative who wants to reform the government school system, know this. You are at best irrelevant. At worst, you are a loyalist. You are a loyalist to the regime, a loyalist to the government school system, a loyalist to the single most immoral institution in America. And you should be ashamed. Thank you.